Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Bipartisanship isn't talked about much these days. Instead, our political parties seem to be moving further apart on the issues. And yet, even in this divisive atmosphere, our guests today say, let's be optimistic about our ability to work together. We're talking with two former congressmen, a Republican and a Democrat, about their new effort called Let's Fix Washington. It started in their home state of Florida, but now they're taking their show on the road to schools and other groups, anyone who wants to hear their bipartisan message. Today, they're in New Hampshire speaking at UNH Law. And Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Has the time for bipartisanship passed? Or is this the perfect time for it right now? Let us know what you think. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. And in addition to listening today, you can also watch our show on Facebook Live. Our guests are former Republican Congressman David Jolly. He represented Florida's 13th district from 2014 to 17. And Congressman Jolly, welcome to New Hampshire. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Also with us, former Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy. He represented Florida's 18th district from 2013 to 17. And Congressman Murphy, nice to meet you too. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, both of you, but I'll start with you, Congressman Jolly. Given that the primaries around the country, some exceptions, but in the primaries around the country this year, most of the energy seemed to be on the left for the Democrats and on the right for the Republicans. Moderate establishment candidates have not, in general, been having a good time this year, New Hampshire being an exception. Why is this the time that, you know, you guys are coming out with this bipartisan message?
I love that question because what Patrick and I often like to point out is we too often conflate bipartisanship with being moderate. Moderate is actually an ideology. We're talking about a platform where people of all ideologies can call home. Conservative, progressive, moderate, whatever your ideology might be, why is it that we see those ideologies refusing to work together in Washington? And so rather than try to change people's ideology, frankly, we often get called moderates, but in partisan warfare, the left would call me a right-wing extremist and the right would call me a progressive rhino. And ideologies get banted about. We're talking about unrigging the system. What are the structural challenges in Washington, D.C. that disincentivize consensus among the ideologies? And we will get to it, but if you look at gerrymandering and our primary systems and campaign finance, the reality is the system has incentivized gridlock as opposed to incentivizing bipartisanship.
So this isn't about being a political moderate. This is about bipartisanship, trying to find common ground solutions to our nation's most pressing problems by working together in some fashion.
That's exactly right. Look, you can look at macro numbers and it suggests we're a country that's roughly 50-50. We're somewhere purple, center, right, whatever it might be. But to suggest that we are only that ignores the conviction of true progressives and true conservatives. We want those true progressives and true conservatives at the table as well.
What do you think, Congressman Murphy? Again, the energy these days seems to be on the right and the left, not in this spirit of bipartisanship.
There's no doubt if you look at the trend, the norm is going toward the extremes. However, you are seeing examples. Connor Lamb is a good one on the Democratic side of a blue dog Democrat winning a particular race. So, you know, candidates matter. Elections matter. The way those campaigns are run all matter. And timing does count. I think more than anything, this election is going to be about Donald Trump, right? He has made this singularly about himself, and Democrats are going to run against him, and Republicans have a tough decision. Are they going to support him or you know, go against him in their campaign? So that is really what this election to me is about. But Democrats have a lot of growing pains to go through. I think we're going to see 15, 20, maybe 25, you know, Democrats running for president in 2020.
And wait, say that number again?
Get
ready. Because I'm here in New Hampshire, so, you know.
They're coming to you, New Hampshire. I mean, Dave and I could probably both rattle off 10, 15 names right off the bat of people that are very seriously considering running for president. And quite frankly, looking back at the 2016 election, it probably would have been healthy for the Democratic Party to have a bigger primary to kind of think through where they really stand on these issues.
Well, before we get into some of the stuff that you mentioned, Congressman Jolly, you know, campaign finance and gerrymandering and some of the issues that the structural issues that you guys feel are preventing bipartisanship, let's get a little bit of your own political histories. You were both members of Congress from swing districts, so you had reach out to a broader electorate. Congressman Murphy, you were a former Republican. You changed to Democrat, but some in your current party call you a Wall Street Democrat. Again, this is, seems like a party that's moving more and more towards the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. Is this a political era that you are just not participating in? I mean, I'm just wondering if you're sort of outdated for the party where it is now.
Could be. We both could be. Who knows what's going on
By
anymore?
By the way, I can come up with much better insults for Patrick.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out a way to put this nicely.
So I'll be quick with the bio. My dad's Republican. So when I, you know, registered to vote, my dad's my best friend and mentor. I said, heck, I guess I'm a Republican too. So that's why I registered. Finance and accounting background, CPA, so I, you know, I'm fiscally responsible.
So that Wall Street moniker sticks a little
bit? I'm a pro-business Democrat, right? I'm fiscally responsible, I'd say, and socially progressive. And when I first started thinking about getting involved in public service, it was because I was tired of complaining, tired of pointing a finger at so many issues, saying all these issues, the debt and unemployment and healthcare and climate change, are all probably going to affect my generation more than my parents and grandparents. And most of my friends don't even care about what's going on, hardly even vote. Who the heck am I to sit around and complain? So that's when I started really getting serious about running for office and looking at the issues and kind of studying where the parties had evolved. I said, hey, as a Democrat, I can be fiscally responsible, socially progressive, and I don't have to change anything from the primary to the general election. And as a Republican, I felt, at least in the particular district I was in, that I was going to have to run way to the right on certain issues and then try to come back to the middle. I have no interest in talking out of both sides of my mouth, so I changed parties and am comfortable as a, you know, pro-business Democrat. But to your point, that is a group of people that are, you know, dwindling pretty quickly in the Congress and in ranks across the country because that progressive spirit is taking over, as is the further right spirit. And I'll let David talk about, you know, his own, you know, future as well. But we believe, and we have heard time after time, that you know, people want that consensus. They want people to work together, saying, what happened to our parties? Our parties have both left us. So, you know, is there a time for a third party, or are you going to see a unity ticket where Republicans and Democrats run together? Something is going to come out of this. That we know.
So even though this effort that you guys are working on is more about bipartisanship, it sounds like you're calling yourself a moderate Democrat, a so-called vanishing breed.
Yes, I want to get things done, right? I care about finding that middle ground and compromising, right? I have my passions and my beliefs, but at the end of the day, I care about progress more than that and wanting to move the ball forward. So, yes, if that's a dirty word, then so be it.
All right, so how about you, Congressman Jolly? As you said just a moment ago, some in your party say you're just a rhino, Republican in name only, and by the way, that you're not helping the party by being so critical of President Trump. So are you a vanishing breed, a moderate Republican?
I like to think we're the future of the party. It might be naive, but I call myself a bull moose Republican. A lot of people may remember that reference from Teddy Roosevelt. You know, look, Teddy Roosevelt over 100 years ago talked about campaign finance reform, and he talked about breaking up big banks and big corporations. In modern day political theory, why aren't Republicans talking about LGBT issues and marriage equality and climate change and reasonable gun control and these issues? Because the reality is that's where the heart of the country actually is ideologically. For me, first time I ever ran for office, much like Patrick, was Congress. And I joke, when I got into my first race, I was polling at 1.5%. and the margin of error was 4. But it was a one-county race, and I ran based on traditional Republican principles. But I could sense then, this was after the whole Sarah Palin had come on the stage, I could sense then that I was having to cultivate support in a party that was much further to the right than I was. I kind of came of age, yes, during Reagan, but really Bush 41 was the first campaign I worked on as a young Republican. And that breed is kind of gone within the Republican Party. In modern day, once elected, in 2015, a year before the election, took to the House floor to call on Donald Trump to drop out of the race. And I did so after his call for a Muslim ban because I saw principles that he was espousing that did not reflect one who I thought we should be as a country first and foremost, but as a party I thought were damaging.
Clearly. So Congressman Murphy switched. How come you didn't switch?
You know, I joke because I'm not sure I want to jump from one dysfunctional family to another right now. But the reality is I think there are a lot of people who, as they see both parties move to the further extremes, are looking for a political home.
So where is your political home?
I don't have one right now. And as we were looking, you know, once you get elected, you always get mentioned, are you going to run again? You know, one of the harsh realities in today's politics is I don't have a donor base now as a result of having been critical of the president and of the Republican Party. I'm not sure what my future holds. It's probably not within the Republican Party in this decade, if you will.
Where's your political home, Congressman Murphy?
I like to think it's in the Democratic Party. I like the thought of all these ideas out there from the far progressives to the blue dogs. And I'm hopeful that in 2020, a candidate will emerge that can unite all of those views. I probably can't name that person today. I don't know who it is that will emerge. But I think generally speaking, that there is agreement among both parties and both extremes of the party that people are angry. And they're upset about a core principle that they don't believe that their kids are going to have as much opportunity as they did, right? And you can boil that down. You know, some people are mad at immigration. Some people, you know, caught under the Muslim ban. Some people blame technology and this revolution we're going through. Then the middle class that's disappearing, trade wars, all these different things that are happening and moving so quick that I think people feel it's out of their control. So I think there will be candidates and policies that emerge that unite all of those sort of that anger and those beliefs that are out there and come up hopefully with some constructive policies to address them. What we're seeing out of the White House right now, in my opinion, isn't the way to approach those. And I think, and I'm hopeful that someone in the Democratic Party will be able to address that.
If I may add something very important here, Patrick mentions unity, and we often talk about who can be a unifying figure for the parties, right? Will there be a Barack Obama that emerges on the Democratic side that can bring together, say, the Joe Biden wing and the Elizabeth Warren wing? Doris Kearns Goodwin said something this morning, the presidential historian. She said, all of the great movements in American history have actually started because the people took the lead and gave cover to political leaders to then embrace those solutions. So from women's rights to equality to civil rights, there was a growing movement among the populace that then gave permission for political leaders to step out and make hard decisions. Within our own parties, as we have all these fights and as we're seeing the energy on the far extremes, at some point within each party, we as the people have to give permission to our partisan leaders to unite us. If we go through a primary and then remain fully divided, we're only hurting ourselves. I would say Trump is the exception because we are seeing a narrative espoused by a party leader that is unlike anything we've seen before. But in the traditional lane of politics, I think as partisan actors, we need to be ready to unite behind our leader coming to 2020.
Well, maybe the traditional lanes of politics have been blown up and you can't travel them anymore.
Well, I think that's a very tough question for Democrats.
For Democrats, not Republicans?
Well, because Republicans have already cast their lot. I mean, Republicans have blown up the traditional lane, and it's an all or nothing. You're with Donald Trump or you're not, and it's why people like me perhaps don't see a future in the party. Democrats, despite their fights between, say, the Connor Lambs and the Ocasio-Cortez, it's still a family conversation that hasn't imploded. And I think that's the test for 2020. As we see this family conversation among Democratic presidential candidates, can they unite?
Let me remind our listeners that we'd love to hear from you this morning. Today in the exchange, we're talking with two former congressmen, a Republican and a Democrat, about their new effort called Let's Fix Washington. Now, it started in their home state of Florida, but now they're taking their show on the road to schools and other groups, anybody who really wants to hear their bipartisan message. Today, they're in New Hampshire speaking at UNH Law. And if you want to know more about that, the program is at noon, and you can go to our website to find out more. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And we'd love to hear from you right now. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And our show is also on Facebook Live today, so you can watch as well as listen. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. One of you said in a recent interview, and I was watching, you know, a lot of videos and interviews with you guys yesterday to get ready for today. I think it was you, Congressman Murphy. Something has happened in the past 10 years to pull us apart and set us in our corners. And pardon me if that was you, Congressman Jolly. But what do you think, Congressman Murphy? What is that something?
It's a good question. We both, I think, kind of agree on this, so it could have been attributed to either of us, quite frankly. But there is a certain amount of anger in the world, and we are seeing extremism winning, populism, and authoritarianism winning all over the place.
Yeah, not just in the U.S.
Right. We saw it with Brexit and Hungary and Poland, recent elections, and Sweden and Germany, right? And the Philippines, Colombia, Mexico. I mean, you name it, this is happening everywhere. So Donald Trump really shouldn't be a surprise because there's a certain amount of anger out there. I think that's the sort of deeper, you know, issue. As it relates specifically to our system, I believe, and as does David, that the system is rigged to reward this sort of extreme behavior where the extremes get more attention and you almost have to be to win. That starts off with the money. More and more money is going toward the edges of the parties. That starts off with online fundraising. A vast majority of money for the progressives and the far right is being raised online. And how do you get that attention? By saying more out of the box crazy things, extreme ideas. If I go and send an email to my list of, ever many thousands of people and say, hey, kumbaya, let's all go get along, I'm not going to raise any money. But if I send an email out saying, hey, we're going to go impeach Donald Trump tomorrow, rally the troops, let's go, I need your help, I'm going to raise thousands of dollars. Right? People want that passion. So the money is a piece of that. The gerrymandering, the 90% of congressional districts are rigged to support one part or the other. 90%, right? A lot of people don't realize that. So only 10% are actually moderate swing districts. In those 90%, if you're in a safe, say, Democratic seat, the way you win that election is to win a primary. So in order to win a primary, you have to appeal to the people who are going to vote for you,
of course. You have to excite the base.
Right. On average, that primary turnout is something like 15%. So you have 15% of the country determining 90% of your members of Congress. So if you're a candidate or you're actually in office in one of those seats, you know exactly what it takes to get elected or reelected. And that's who you appeal to, that 15%. The other 85%, in many cases, almost don't matter because they're not going to sway the election. So you do and say what they want. And members of Congress and candidates become followers, really, of that 15% and keep trying to outdo each other to that extreme. And that has really started to separate us. And the third element I'll add real quick is the media. And I don't mean you on NPR here, but you look at the Foxes and the MSNBCs, and then you look at the websites, and then even worse now is the social media, the Facebooks, and then the Twitter, where people are living in bubbles and oftentimes don't even realize it, right? And they're going to certain websites that are reconfirming their current beliefs. So all of a sudden we keep hearing and hearing and reading the same exact thing, and we all become rigid in those beliefs and we can never see the other side. And it's not even news as much anymore. It's opinion pieces constantly. So we're all becoming, I think, more insular in our beliefs. And you can see this even in where we're living, right? In the more urban versus rural areas and only hearing these sort of, and living in these echo chambers. So you combine all that together and you've got a mess on your hands.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and we should definitely talk about those themes that you raised, the money, the media, the gerrymandering, and so forth. But just real quick, picking up on something you said, Congressman Murphy and Congressman Jolly, I wonder what you think. Congressman Murphy talked about, if you want to raise money, you got to raise passion. How does somebody raise passion around the idea of bipartisanship? Vote for me and I'll work with the other guy.
The solution is Bill Clinton felt your pain, Donald Trump felt your anger. We need political leaders that recognize there are real issues affecting human lives. You can create emotion and passion around that without having to make people angry and stoke their anger even more.
All right. We will follow up a lot more after a short break. We'll talk about the money issue, gerrymandering, how these districts are drawn, some ideas that you guys have. as well. And let's start hearing from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. What do you think about this move, this call for more bipartisanship in America? 1-800-892-6477.
What's happening in the midterm elections before you vote in November is important. But what about what's going to happen in December or January? Hi, I'm Lauren Chulgin, politics and policy reporter for NHPR. When you give each month as a sustainer, you help NHPR and NPR cover the entire election. What happened before, what's going on now, and especially what's coming next. Be a part of what comes next. Become an NHPR sustainer today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, two former Florida congressmen, a Republican and a Democrat, are in New Hampshire promoting their new effort called Let's Fix Washington, Breaking Through Political Dysfunction and Faulty Fiscal Policy. Now, they'll be speaking at UNH Law at noon today. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And let's hear from you right now. What do you make of this message of bipartisanship that these gentlemen are promoting, especially in this era when our parties seem to be moving more towards the right and the left? Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, and you can watch our show on Facebook Live today. Our guests are former Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy. He represented Florida's 18th District from 2013 to 17, and former Republican Congressman David Jolly. He represented Florida's 13th District from 2014 to 17. And gentlemen, before we go to our listeners, I did want to talk to both of you about gerrymandering, because this has been in the news, especially with the elections coming up. There have been court cases. Some of them made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But just backtracking a little bit, and maybe to you, Congressman Jolly, first, what's your best definition of gerrymandering?
Well, you can go back basically to some of the founding documents in the very early days of our government to draw lines that favor one political party or another. What happened through a deliberate effort beginning in the 1990s with the emergence of big data and Republicans taking over the Congress, is they created a 50-state plan to gerrymander as many seats as possible. Now, very importantly for people to understand, congressional district lines, lines for your members of Congress, are actually drawn at the state level, not in Washington.
A lot of people don't realize
that. That's right. And most of those are drawn by state legislators, which are partisan actors, if you will. They have created these supermajority districts. As Patrick said, now 90% of the seats in Congress are for one party or the other.
That's an astronomical number, by the way.
It is. Now, some
I knew it was high. I didn't realize it was 90%. That high.
So now, and very importantly, some of those districts reflect natural geographic constituencies, right? In the Manhattan area, there's a seat that favors Democrats by 41 or 42. In deep red Texas, there's one that favors a Republican by 42 or 44. But for the most part, you could draw competitive districts that are 50-50. Partisan legislators in state houses simply don't do that. The good news, though, is we are seeing reforms to gerrymandering move through the states. Arizona has an independent redistricting commission that voters demanded by amending their constitution, and the Supreme Court has said that is okay. You can do that.
So Arizona will not be drawing these lines on a partisan basis.
It's drawn
anymore
by an independent redistricting commission. The case you may have referred to that just went to the Supreme Court was out of Wisconsin, and the question they faced is how much politics is too much politics. Wisconsin is a good example. In a recent study, roughly 54% of Wisconsin voters voted for Democrats in their state legislature, but Democrats only won about 46% of the seats because of the way it's been gerrymandered. So that went all the way to Supreme Court. The quick nickel on the Supreme Court is they have always wrestled with whether or not it is a political decision, a raw political decision, outside of the purview of the courts, or whether there is a question of too much partisanship and gerrymandering. Around 2000, they said, we're going to consider whether there's too much politics. They came out with an answer that said, yes, there is too much politics, and the courts can intervene, but then there's no discernible standard the court can establish to determine when it actually crosses the line. those two questions, is it justiciable and what crosses the line, were the questions coming out of Wisconsin before the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court is going to continue to rule against gerrymandering reform advocates. Today's court simply thinks that it is too much of a political question that the court should be very cautious to approach. It would require a change in the court to change that opinion. But the fundamental good news for voters who are concerned about this is you can change your state constitution today. We're seeing fair district amendments move through the states. Florida just passed one. The voters passed one to require geographic compactness in drawing states. And the Florida Supreme Court made the legislature draw the lines accordingly.
Fair district amendments. So these are happening in states around the country where people say, I don't want my districts drawn by, you know, when Republicans have power or when Democrats have power. Go ahead, Congressman Murphy.
Right. We've seen different examples play out where you have, you know, computers drawing maps that are supposed to be statistically more even districts, where you have independent panels drawing districts. In California, they had an approach called the top two system, where in a primary, whomever finishes number one and two moves on to the general election. That could be a Republican and Democrat. It could be two Democrats. It could be two Republicans, you know, any combination there.
It could be a different party.
Different party. Whoever finishes one and two. In theory, what that does then in the general election is helps or incentivizes those candidates to get back to the middle to appeal to the rest of the folks that are out there, not to the extreme. Talking to our friends in California that are in Congress, you get varying opinions of whether it's working or not. Most people are adverse to change, but generally speaking, I think you've seen the state legislature, for sure, legislature in California, move more to the middle. They passed a state budget there for the first time in, like, you know, however many years, like 10 years or something, recently after these reforms. So it is incentivizing that sort of behavior to actually get things done, where the voters are going to theoretically reward that kind of behavior for solving problems because more people are actually involved in the process now. They're not cut out anymore like they are in so many districts across the country. In the case of Florida, it was a step in the right direction. It wasn't enough, though. The districts are still gerrymandered, is still dramatically weighed toward Republicans in Florida, but is going to keep improving. And people are realizing that with these ballot initiatives, they can actually make progress.
So what incentive, Congressman Murphy, do state lawmakers have to sign on to these, you know, wonderful bipartisan, nonpartisan, whatever commissions, given that if you're a Republican and you're in power at the State House, you want to draw those districts. You don't want to give somebody else a turn.
Yeah, I can't think of any incentive they have, actually. I'm not sure.
So how does it even happen?
So it's really got to be driven by the voters.
It has to be a ballot initiative.
A ballot initiative.
Which we don't have here in New Hampshire. We have constitutional questions, but that's a very high hurdle. In Maine, they have tons of, you know, referenda. So it just kind of depends on the political culture of the state, too.
And so the next step would be the voters actually holding those, you know, folks accountable right at the ballot box and making this a critical issue. Because if the structure is not right, then the policies that flow from that aren't going to be right either. And so that's kind of the point Dave and I are making. Look, we could sit here and fight about immigration reform and health care and all these important issues, but it's kind of beyond that at this point. The structure isn't allowing any debate to happen on these issues, right? When we were in Congress, the majority of the time was trying to be partisan, right? Our party leadership was trying to pit us against each other and didn't want us to work together.
Well, that's the fundraising that both of you talked about.
That's the fundraising,
before.
But it's also this fundamental belief that Republicans, and one example said, hey, we are not going to let Patrick Murphy pass any legislation because we don't want to give him a good headline back home because that would help him get reelected. We are going to beat him in 2 years from now. And Democrats saying, we're going to spend $2 million to beat David Jolly. We're not going to let him get a piece of legislation passed. Forget that.
I see. So even if he had a really good idea that you wanted to sign on to, your party leadership would say, no, Patrick,
no.
Don't do that. We want to beat this guy in 2 years.
Really? It's happened to both of us, which is why we always point to this example. And it happened in my first month in office where I'm saying, what are you talking about? I have an idea to cut $300 billion of wasteful spending, duplicative spending in our country. Republicans, Democrats, independents all agree, right? This is our taxpayer money that's being abused. Let's cut it. And the individual Republican that I was working with on that legislation came to me after about 6 weeks and said, Patrick, you know, Speaker Boehner came to me and said, I can't work with you on this. You know, we are trying to beat you in a couple of years, and he would drop me from my committee or prevent me from raising money if I do. So I'm sorry, Murph, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. This is going to be a Democratic bill at this point.
Wow.
Individuals who are on the terrorist watch list are still allowed today to buy firearms because the system is rigged for partisanship, not for compromise. We had a compromise. We had the votes. but party leaders on each side of the aisle were not going to permit that to happen. I will tell you, Laura, this is a question that goes back to the very founders, to the Federalist Papers. And if you were to give a modern-day example, it's this. My first election, I was elected with 48% of the vote. When I got to Congress, the question is, do I owe representation to only those 48% that supported me, or do I owe representation to all 100%? Now, imagine if that number was 60 and my district was 60% Republicans. Well, the reality is, if you create a system where Republicans only have to answer to Republicans and Democrats only have to answer to Democrats, then Republicans are going to behave like Republicans and Democrats are going to behave like Democrats. If you suggest that every member is slightly vulnerable by strictly acting as a partisan, but there is security in reaching beyond their own party, not abandoning their fundamental tenets, but recognizing that the duty is to represent 100% of their constituency, now we have a political environment that's working again. You could make the case, though, that you run on a partisan platform, you've said what you're going to do, you win one more vote than the next person, and so you have license to do that. I make a political value judgment and don't subscribe to that theory of representation.
So party leaders, I'm kind of stunned by the story that Congressman Murphy told. Party leaders, Congressman Jolly, say to you guys, don't work together in a bipartisan way to solve the country's most pressing issues, because that'll help the other party, and our first priority is winning.
Patrick referred to a common sense budget reduction bill that he had, and
you mentioned
that my side of the aisle,
you mentioned a gun bill.
John Boehner killed for mine. It was coming out of the Pulse nightclub shooting. I was from Florida. I went to Congress. Democrats had their sit-in, so I fly back to Washington. Democrats shut down the House and sit in on the House floor for about 2 days. They had a very reasonable proposal that if you're not allowed to buy a plane ticket because you're on the watch list, you shouldn't be able to buy an assault weapon. Makes perfect sense. I agreed with them. The one flaw that I saw in the bill, which I stand by today, was that there was no due process.
For somebody who was on the watch list by mistake, and we've all heard those stories.
Well, and frankly, flying on an airplane is not in the Constitution, but the Second Amendment is, whatever your interpretation is. So my point was, if you're going to unilaterally deny, without explanation, the right of an individual to purchase a firearm, that individual should be afforded due process. We reached an agreement in the middle of the night.
With Democrats.
With Democrats, the rank-and-file members. I said, I can deliver about 35 votes if Democrats can deliver their caucus. And I said, take my bill, reintroduce it under a Democratic name. You don't have to even give me credit for it. I wake up the next morning, and one of the Democratic colleagues of mine comes to me and says, I'll leave his name out, but this member of our leadership said, we're not doing that. We're about to spend $3 million to beat Jolly in November. We're not going to give him a win. Now, this happens on both sides of the aisle, and I realize this is a pretty damning story that I'm telling about Democrats. It does happen on both sides
of
the aisle. Republicans are guilty.
Told us, yeah.
But Laura, it is heartbreaking to realize. I mean, I was on CNN that morning, and one of the anchors said, this is far too reasonable. It makes too much sense. The reason it didn't get done is because of the pure politics of the Democrats wanting to beat me 3 months later.
All right, exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Lots of people lining up. We'd love your thoughts about what our guests are saying today, how the very structure of Congress is stacked against people coming together to solve problems. And our guests point to several reasons why. One is leadership, as we're hearing. Another is gerrymandering. Another is money in politics. Another is media. We'd love your thoughts on this broad discussion that we're having today. Our guests say they have a cure for political dysfunction, and we're hearing some of their ideas. We'd love to hear your ideas as well. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go first to Rich in Concord. Hi, Rich. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. When the congressman was talking in the beginning about the factors in polarization, he mentioned online fundraising as a big one. But the other thing, which maybe he talked about later when we were when I was on hold getting connected, he left off Citizens United. And I know for me, the big donors have made me far less enthusiastic about sending in donations.
Small contributions.
I gave money to Obama and McCain, back in 2008, because until you got that airhead, but, you know, I don't get inspired about giving money, because it seems like money I might contribute is going to make so little difference compared to all the other things that are being donated.
So, Rich, thank you for the call. And by the way, you know, we won't insult people and call them airheads on the air, because everybody has their beliefs and their style. But it's interesting that he gave to both McCain and Obama about a decade ago, Congressman Murphy. Let's talk about Citizens United.
Mm-hmm. Richard, great question. Thank you for that. We could spend the whole hour here talking about, you know, the money in politics and what needs to change. And I'll let David come in here in a second, because if you haven't seen it, he was on 60 Minutes while in office, was very courageous in exposing the fundraising and how bad it is in the Congress right now. That's an episode worth, you know, Googling and checking out. But the way I stand on campaign finance reform is anything we can do to improve it would help. I'm not going to pin myself on one reform or another, but none of it starts until you change Citizens United. As long as you can have these outside groups or individuals, billionaires, basically giving, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to candidates or parties, you're going to have a very rigged system. The candidates and the members of Congress know exactly who's giving that money and the issues they care about. The policies coming out of Washington are oftentimes dictated to benefit those groups and those individuals. I'll let David tell a story here, but I had an individual donor tell me if I changed my vote that they would give me $15 million to my next campaign, right? These kind of things
happen. I thought we weren't allowed
happen.
To accept large donations
that's,
like that.
Well, that's Citizens United, right? That was the 2010 Supreme Court case.
And illegal.
Right, and completely right.
It's still illegal, right? But people do it
through these super PACs, and yeah, I
mean, who are not supposed to communicate with you, by the way.
Right.
Well, and that's the bigger issue. And to Rich's point, all of that, those millions of dollars, are going to outside groups to define the candidates. The
right.
reality is, the small dollar contributions most often are going to the candidates themselves, so the candidates can define themselves. We are quickly going to get to a point where candidate money almost doesn't matter. In my first race, there was about $14 million spent in 10 weeks. I raised $1.4 million. So you can imagine all of that other money was uncoordinated, used to define me. Even people in support of me were defining me as somebody I wasn't. That's where the impact of Citizens United is coming in. These seats are now becoming commodities between these large corporate donors, and the candidates' own voices almost don't matter.
We've seen that sometimes in campaigns here in New Hampshire, where a group puts out a particularly inflammatory ad, and even the Republican or Democrat that is supposedly helped by that says, hey, that goes over the line, pull it down. On the other hand, we just saw in New Hampshire, we held our primaries just last week, we just saw in New Hampshire a candidate who had a ton of outside money brought in on her behalf. Maura Sullivan, Emily's List, Vet Votes or something like that. And she was not the victor, even though she outspent her rival. So these outside groups don't always manage to make things go their way.
You're exactly right. In Florida, in the Democratic primary and the Republican primary, for that matter, the Democrat who won the Florida gubernatorial primary, there were five candidates in the race. The individual that had basically the least amount of money in that race, Andrew Gillum, ended up winning that race. There were two candidates that spent $30+ million of their own money and came in third and fourth place there. So same thing on the Republican side. Adam Putnam had more money than Ron DeSantis and lost by almost 20 points. So it's not always the case. And back to Rich's point there, those $2 and $5 and $10 contributions, while they may seem minimal, do really matter. And
they
do
add
make
up.
A difference. And they really do add up. And it may seem trivial, and I feel like a politician, you're asking for money, but giving those checks to support what you believe in really does matter. Don't put your hands up and give up, because it's sending a really bad signal.
Well, Rich, I really appreciate the call. And gentlemen, a bunch of emails are coming in too, so I want to encourage folks to send email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. And coming up, I want to ask you guys a little bit more about the role of the media, both traditional and social media, because you alluded to that. Also, some of the rules in Washington used to circumvent a bipartisan process. There's been a lot of talk lately about regular order and what that is, and I know you have some thoughts on that. So all that's coming up. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the status of co-ed sports in our schools and our communities. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, two former congressmen from Florida join us, a Republican and a Democrat. They're here in New Hampshire talking about their new effort called Let's Fix Washington. They'll be speaking at UNH Law later today. Go to our website to find out more. And give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. Send email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And in addition to listening, you can watch us on Facebook Live today. And our guests again are former Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy, former Republican Congressman David Jolly, and both of you right back to our listeners. And here's a question that came in from Walter in Portsmouth, who says, in the 20th century, members of Congress move with their family to Washington to do their job. Representatives and senators and their spouses from both sides met each other's houses. They cooperated more. Now the Washington is seen as a part-time job. One commutes to D.C. at the taxpayer's expense and leaves one's family behind. It has not worked, Walter says. Regular order does not happen. We cannot even get the 12 finance bills required to run the government past before a fiscal year begins. Walter, thank you. Two questions here. One is more of a cultural question, and another is more of a procedural question. Let's take the cultural question first, and I'll turn to you, I think, Congressman Murphy, first. What about the idea that, you know, before we had really fast airplanes, people used to hang out in Washington together. You want to take that one, Congressman Jolly? They would hang out. People say the same thing, by the way, old-timers here in New Hampshire say the same thing, that before I-93 was built, and this is going back a ways, that New Hampshire lawmakers used to hang out at the Highway Hotel. They would gather on the piano. Right. They would drink. They would sing. And by gum, they would solve legislation.
No, you nailed it.
So here's the same point in terms of D.C. that our listeners making.
Sam Gibbons, a congressman from Florida, longtime member, chairman of Ways and Means at one point, said bipartisanship ended with the invention of the jet airplane. And turned that into a joke. What does one member of Congress say to the other on Wednesday night? See you next week. The reality is, members do fly home. And look, you can make the case that members should be in their districts more.
They should be in touch with their
people.
You
can absolutely make that case. I do think, and I know Patrick agrees with this, it has compromised the ability to work together and get things done, specifically because, and all of this ties in together, you arrive in Washington just in time for the first vote. You are scripted. Most of your activities are scripted by your party and your fundraising activities for the 72 hours you're in Washington. I could tell you the names of every member on my side of the aisle. I would have struggled to tell you more than the names of more than 50 Democrats simply because
you don't get together.
You never see them. You never meet them.
There was an effort made in New Hampshire, I think, or maybe it was in Congress, where you had to sit next to somebody from the other party. Was that during the State of the Union?
Some members during the State of the Union.
That's it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I participated in that. It's a good program.
Yeah.
We both did, but you have to force yourself to meet people on the other side of the aisle. And even within your own party, it's becoming more insular. On the Democratic side, the progressives are starting to hang out more, and the Blue Dogs are hanging out in the Tea
and
Party.
People have their caucuses.
And even within the parties, it's becoming very divided. So I might not get to know the Progressive Caucus very much because that's not the caucus I'm part of. So it's getting worse and worse. And, you know, we always sort of joked if there was a budget to keep people in D.C. where their families could live there, where they could play golf on weekends and socialize and the kids could play soccer together or whatever, it becomes human. And it's not just an object where I can just go on CNN and call David a communist at night. I have dinner at his house Friday night. His wife's cooking dinner for me. I'm not going to go on TV and call him a name, right? Otherwise, I'm probably going to get poisoned or something. So, I mean, it sounds funny, but it's true, where then there becomes a human element there where you're not going to be so derogatory. And you're going to see where that person's coming from. I mean, some of the best experiences I had in Congress were doing these CODELs, these trips overseas, where you are going to Afghanistan. I had a chance to go to Afghanistan with Michelle Bachmann. Right. I mean, someone
who's very conservative.
Very conservative. I don't know if there's many issues we agreed on, but I understood more about where she was from.
CODELs means co-delegation members of both parties. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. You see where they're coming from, their beliefs, and you understand them. And we were able to work on legislation because of that trip, and that helped us get together. So he's exactly right. You combine that with a lack of regular order where bills aren't going through the normal process, and you have a real breakdown.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. And by the way, our Civics 101 podcast here on NHPR has done an episode on regular order, a refresher on how that works. But just remind us, Congressman Jolly, what is regular order and why are people on both sides, by the way, often shouting that regular order is not being followed?
Yeah, I've worked on Capitol Hill for roughly 20 years. I had every job from intern to chief of staff to press to district to member of Congress. when I first started there, bills originated in committees, like you learn about in elementary school and in civics. And the subject matter experts at a subcommittee level elevated it to the committee level. It then went to the rules committee, made it to the floor. An open process allowed members to amend it. You passed it and went to the other chamber. We have gotten so far past that because of all these problems, and not to revisit them, but they all do tie in together, all of the misincentives or disincentives, if you will, and particularly the money, to the point where now leadership makes a decision of what legislation they're going to move. If it's the Affordable Care Act or the Affordable Care Act repeal, if it's the tax bill, all those decisions are made either by Paul Ryan or by Nancy Pelosi, by Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer, and they are forced top down, and you are told how you are going to vote. And if you don't vote with them, you lose millions of dollars in fundraising for your next cycle. That's the reality of where we are.
So some of us of a certain age remember Schoolhouse Rock. You know, exactly. I'm just a bill. I'm only a bill. I'm sitting here in Capitol Hill. That process is not what happens now.
That song belongs in the National Archives. It is not operating in Capitol
Hill. So when and why and how did this change?
I think a lot of it started probably because of the money. And the party leadership controlling so many of the big groups that are out there on both sides of the aisle and able to dictate, hey, Laura, in your next election, if you want this $2 million, I'm simplifying this, but if you want this, you know, $2 million, you better vote this way and you better have a scorecard that is in line with what our beliefs are. And what that's really done is disincentivize members from getting involved in some of the issues and really spending the time necessary to understand an issue and work that through the committees and build the relationships necessary, because they know they're going to show up on Tuesday and they're going to get, you know, a card with the 12 votes of the day, and here's how you're going to vote, and party leadership dictates that. Say, what am I doing here? My job is now all of a sudden just to go raise money and get reelected. It's sort of laughable. And that's what Dave and I are so mad about, and a big part of why we both decided on, you know, of course, different parties, that we are going to run for the U.S. Senate, because at least in my case, I thought yes, it's still dysfunctional, but at least a chance where you can be involved in the process and have your voice on the policies and the issues that matter.
More so in the U.S. Senate than in the U.S. House.
Okay. And if I may, the parties have set themselves up by so insulating and protecting their own caucuses. All of these supermajority protections have actually created a system where each party becomes risk-averse and neither party wants an open vote on anything. There was a clear example. Republicans shut down the House because Democrats were offering an amendment to ban the Confederate flag from federal properties, and they were offering an amendment to prevent LGBT discrimination. Republicans were terrified to take that vote because they knew it would pass the House, and they couldn't allow it to pass the House because they had so rigged the system for supermajority Republicans back home that they couldn't actually sell those messages to ban the Confederate flag and to ban LGBT discrimination.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. And, gentlemen, let's take a call from South Berwick, Maine. Claire is on the line. And, Claire, you guys have experimented with politics and campaign finance and elections. So go ahead. Glad to hear from you.
Oh, yeah. I'm really glad that you mentioned that the idea of representing all of the constituency instead of just those who voted for you. It seems to me that parties are not listed anywhere in the Constitution, and what they're really doing is interfering with the constitutional representation. What can we do to reduce the power of parties in our governmental process? Things like deciding who's the chair of a committee, deciding what gets voted on, or who works with whom, because it seems to me it's just unconscionable that we're allowing the separate, essentially a large lobbying group, to decide what our elected representatives are doing for us.
Yeah, Claire, thanks a lot for the question. Both of you, but maybe you first, Congressman Jolly. Yeah,
look, George Washington himself warned against factions. The founders envisioned this arena of competing ideas, but they did not envision factions. Meaning parties, the way they have emerged and matured in the modern political era. At the same time, the Supreme Court has upheld closed associations, going back to an NAACP case in the 1950s. When Patrick and I are talking about these very mechanical issues that are very dry, gerrymander reform, primary reform, campaign finance reform, those are very mechanical issues compared to the passions of talking about gridlock and parties. But the reality is that's how you fix it. Because the reason
through these sort of boring
because the reason
of
parties have the powers and
processes.
The reason that extreme partisanship gets rewarded is because of the way the playing field is now laid out. If we can make it a more competitive playing field, we begin to reward the common sense voices that reach across the aisle. It is what we've identified as a solution to this party gridlock.
And I don't mean to call your solutions boring. I apologize.
No, they are.
It's just more mechanics than,
yeah. But it's effective, and we have seen it. We saw it in Arizona. The reason Arizona is more competitive and people speak to more common sense solutions is because they unrigged their system.
Claire, good to hear from you. What do you think, Congressman Murphy?
Yeah, well, you know, people often ask us in our town halls, you know, what do we think about term limits? And people are very passionate that we need term limits. And you know, initially before I got into office, I would have said, heck yeah, we need term limits. But I think what people really want there, and what I meant by that, of course, was that I want to be able to hold my representative accountable. I want to say he or she is doing a good job or not, hold them accountable. The system is so rigged that you do have people that are in office 20, 30, 40 years now, and they're so sort of ingrained in the system and so powerful that you can't hardly beat them. And that is against, I think, the point of what we're trying to make. It's let's make sure that they're competitive districts. And if they are competitive and you don't like the vote that he or she took, then you vote them out in the next, you know, election. And that, I think, is the idea there. And what happens with term limits is the so-called experts that you would want in office, because there's a lot of complexity in a lot of these issues, isn't there anymore. If you only have someone in office for 8 years, then the staff and the lobbyists become the experts, both of which are unelectable, and that kind of backfires on the voters. So it's important that you have these elected seats, but that they are competitive and you can change them.
Well, and both of you talked a lot about the leadership and told some pretty jaw-dropping stories about times when you had true bipartisan compromise, but your leadership said, no, 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 don't do that. But is it possible, I'll turn to you first, Congressman Murphy, that leadership is responding to what voters want? I mean, maybe there's a good cohort of voters that don't want you to work with the other side.
Yes, well, they know exactly who's going to show up to vote, and they know where their base is.
That primary system that you talked about,
exactly,
where the primaries are so important.
Back to that 15% of the base, the core that's going to show up. And how do you get them out to vote? You can, you know, make sort of two arguments in politics. Do you want to appeal to the middle, those moderates and independents, and get them to vote for you? Or do you want to sort of double down on your base and have a certain amount of passion to drive people out to the polls, to get them out there, motivate them to vote? And we could look at just the last few elections and see very clear examples of this working. And that seems to be the argument now, is let's go to the bases. Let's drive our numbers and force those moderates and independents to pick a team one way or the other. And party leadership has figured that out. And that's, to me, really what they're following, but also the money they're following, because they know who's writing those big checks. It's typically people more on the extreme.
So how do you, Congressman Jolly, drive that passion towards people who are more bipartisan?
So based on a real-life experience, and if I could offer a dose of optimism, at some point, we should all fight for what we believe in, right? There is nothing wrong with fighting for your strictly held ideological beliefs. But my brief time in Congress is probably a story that should invoke some optimism. I ran in a 50-50 district, a Republican in a district President Obama had won twice. I was able to win it twice. It was pure down the middle 50-50, but we had progressives, conservatives, and moderates. It got redrawn to a district that President Obama won by 11, which made it largely uncompetitive for me. My only lament in it being redrawn is, as a Republican, I had taken some pretty unorthodox positions in support of the science behind climate change, LGBT equality, gun control, campaign finance reform. And what I saw in my original district that was 50-50 is I was polling at 57, 58, 59%, numbers that I should not have achieved. My only lament in the redistricting is I wanted to be able to demonstrate to both sides of the aisle, but particularly to my own party, you can approach these issues of consensus, not as a Republican adopting progressive solutions, but embracing traditional progressive issues and saying, let's work together on these issues. I actually think the American people respect consensus as much as they do ideological conviction. We simply don't have a system where we get to see consensus leaders emerge.
Well, here's an email that came in from Mark in Francistown. He says, sadly, I think the divide between Democrats and Republicans moved up significantly to a new level as a result of the 9/11 attacks. Instead of coming together, that was a very, very brief phenomenon, Mark says, the fear took hold, and that fear has created the chronic divide and dysfunction we see all around us. What do you think, Congressman Murphy?
There's no doubt that fear is the easiest emotion to evoke in people. The first opponent I had in politics was Congressman Alan West, and he was a master at this, is scaring the heck out of people. The world is going to come to an end unless you voted for him. Hope is a lot harder emotion to evoke, right? President Obama was as good as we've seen, right, in modern times at doing that. And it's a lot easier to do that. There's no doubt about that. I don't know if it necessarily came just from 9/11. Sometimes I've said it's going to take some sort of catastrophe, unfortunately, to remind people that we're Americans first. We're not Republicans and Democrats first. We're Americans. And I hope it doesn't take that. I hope something happens before that crisis moment. But based on what we're seeing in Washington and capitals across the country, that's what it seems like.
Here's another email that just came in. This person says, thank you for this topic today. I couldn't call in from Nashua, but I appreciate the validation that I'm not really alone, being more moderate, a moderate Democrat, though registered undeclared. This is from Sandy. Sandy says, I think that there are a lot of us who've just kept quiet. And then she says, ... until now.
All right, Sandy.
So she's fired up. So if the two of you are so frustrated by the party system and the way it encourages not working together, Congressman Jolly, why don't you just form a new moderate party?
Well, we pursued.
I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times.
We pursued a unity ticket in Florida as governor,
yes,
lieutenant governor, because at some point we need an alternative to emerge that is viable. And right now, a third party, the barrier to entry is money, and it would probably cost $250 million to do that. We may see that emerge. There are talks right now among Republicans about either challenging Donald Trump in a primary or creating a third party. Laura, I know we're running short on time, and I do want to say thank you to the Concord Coalition for hosting us for a bipartisan talk on the budget issues today at the Rudman Center. It is a leading bipartisan group that we're happy to affiliate.
So, and just to get listeners up to speed, and you're right, we're running out of time, but you guys put forward a proposal for a purple ticket for Florida governor, although Congressman Jolly, you're going to have to explain to me why Congressman Murphy got to be the gubernatorial candidate and you the lieutenant governor, but what's going on with that?
Well, so the deadline, Pat, it was too late in the process to achieve. But the reality of hardcore politics today is there's no pathway for David Jolly in a Republican closed primary. There simply is not. And so Patrick certainly was viable to win that race. And then we combine as a unity ticket. Give everybody a home was our point.
All right. Well, former Congressman David Jolly and Patrick Murphy, they'll be talking at UNH Law today at noon. For more information, go to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And gentlemen, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for coming, Laura.
Thank you very much.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.